Side 4. The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Continuing on page 111. With the apartment as our headquarters, I gradually got Reginald introduced around to Creole Bill's and other Harlem after-hour spots. About 2 o'clock every morning, as the downtown white nightclubs closed, Reginald and I would stand around in front of this or that Harlem after-hours place, and I'd school him to what was happening. Especially after the nightclubs downtown closed, the taxis and black limousines would be driving uptown, bringing those white people who never could get enough of Negro soul. The places popular with these whites ranged all the way from the big locally famous ones, such as Jimmy's Chicken Shack and Dickie Wells, to the little here-tonight, gone-tomorrow-night private clubs, so-called, where a dollar was collected to the door for membership. Inside every after-hour spot, the smoke would hurt your eyes. 4 white people to every Negro would be in there drinking whiskey from coffee cups and eating fried chicken. The generally flushed-faced white men and their makeup-masked, glittery-eyed women would be pounding each other's backs and uproariously laughing and applauding the music. A lot of the whites, drunk, would go staggering up to Negroes, the waiters, the owners, or Negroes at tables, wringing their hands, even trying to hug them. "You're just as good as I am. I want you to know that." The most famous places drew both Negro and white celebrities who enjoyed each other. A jam-packed 4:30 a.m. crowd at Jimmy's Chicken Shack or Dickie Wells might have such jam session entertainment as Hazel Scott playing the piano for Billie Holiday singing the blues. Jimmy's Chicken Shack, incidentally, was where once, later on, I worked briefly as a waiter. That's where Red Fox was the dishwasher who kept the kitchen crew in stitches. After a while, my brother Reginald had to have a hustle, and I gave much thought to what would be for him a good, safe hustle. After he'd learned his own way around, it would be up to him to take risks for himself if he wanted to make more and quicker money. The hustle I got Reginald into really was very simple. It utilized the psychology of the ghetto jungle. Downtown, he paid the $2 or whatever it was for a regular city peddler's license. Then I took him to a manufacturer's outlet where we bought a supply of cheap, imperfect seconds. Shirts, underwear, cheap rings, watches, all kinds of quick sale items. Watching me work this hustle back in Harlem, Reginald quickly caught on how to go into barbershops, beauty parlors, and bars, acting very nervous as he let the customers peep into his small valise of loot. With so many thieves around anxious to get rid of stolen good-quality merchandise cheaply, many Harlemites, purely because of this conditioning, jumped to pay hot prices for inferior goods whose sale was perfectly legitimate. It never took long to get rid of a valise full for at least twice what it had cost. And if any cop stopped Reginald, he had in his pocket both the peddler's license and the manufacturer's outlet bills of sale. Reginald only had to be certain that none of the customers to whom he sold ever saw that he was legitimate. I assumed that Reginald, like most of the Negroes I knew, would go for a white woman. I'd point out Negro-happy white women to him and explain that a Negro with any brains could wrap these women around his fingers. But I have to say this for Reginald. He never liked white women. I remember the one time he met Sophia. He was so cool it upset Sophia, and it tickled me. Reginald got himself a black woman. I guess she was pushing 30, an old settler, as we called them back in those days. She was a waitress in an exclusive restaurant downtown. She lavished on Reginald everything she had. She was so happy to get a young man. I mean, she bought him clothes, cooked and washed for him, and everything, as though he were a baby. That was just another example of why my respect for my younger brother kept increasing. Reginald showed, in often surprising ways, more sense than a lot of working hustlers twice his age. Reginald then was only 16, but a six-footer, he looked and acted much older than his years. All through the war, the Harlem racial picture never was too bright. Tension built to a pretty high pitch. Old-timers told me that Harlem had never been the same since the 1935 riot, when millions of dollars worth of damage was done by thousands of Negroes, infuriated chiefly by the white merchants in Harlem refusing to hire a Negro, even as their stores raked in Harlem's money. During World War II, Mayor LaGuardia officially closed the Savoy Ballroom. Harlem said the real reason was to stop Negroes from dancing with white women. Harlem said that no one dragged the white women in there. Adam Clayton Powell made it a big fight. He had successfully fought Consolidated Edison, the New York Telephone Company, until they had hired Negroes. Then he had helped to battle the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army about their segregating of uniformed Negroes. But Powell couldn't win this battle. City Hall kept the Savoy closed for a long time. It was just another one of the liberal North actions that didn't help Harlem to love the white man any. Finally, rumor flashed that in the Braddock Hotel, white cops had shot a Negro soldier. I was walking down St. Nicholas Avenue. I saw all these Negroes hollering and running north from 125th Street. Some of them were loaded down with armfuls of stuff. I remember it was the band leader Fletcher Henderson's nephew, Shorty Henderson, who told me what had happened. Negroes were smashing store windows and taking everything they could grab and carry. Furniture, food, jewelry, clothes, whiskey. Within an hour, every New York City cop seemed to be in Harlem. Mayor LaGuardia and the NAACP's then secretary, the famed late Walter White, were in a red fire car riding around pleading over a loudspeaker to all of those shouting, milling, angry Negroes to please go home and stay inside. Just recently, I ran into Shorty Henderson on 7th Avenue. We were laughing about a fellow whom the riot had left with the nickname of Left Feet. In a scramble in a women's shoe store, somehow he'd grabbed 5 shoes, all of them for Left Feet. And we laughed about the scared little Chinese whose restaurant didn't have a hand laid on it because the rioters just about convulsed laughing when they saw the sign the Chinese had hastily stuck on his front door. Me, colored, too. After the riot, things got very tight in Harlem. It was terrible for the nightlife people and for those hustlers whose main income had been the white man's money. The 1935 riot had left only a relative trickle of the money which had poured into Harlem during the 1920s. And now this new riot ended even that trickle. Today, the white people who visit Harlem, and this mostly on weekend nights, are hardly more than a few dozen who do the twist, the frug, the watusi, and all the rest of the current dance crazes in Small's Paradise, owned now by the great basketball champion Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain, who draws crowds with his big, clean, all-American athlete image. Most white people today are physically afraid to come to Harlem. And it's for good reasons, too. Even for Negroes, Harlem nightlife is about finished. Most of the Negroes who have money to spend are spending it downtown somewhere in this hypocritical integration, in places where previously the police would have been called to haul off any Negro insane enough to try and get in. The already Croesus-rich white man can't get another skyscraper hotel finished and open before all these integration-mad Negroes, who themselves don't own a tool shed, are booking the swanking new hotel for cotillions and conventions. Those rich whites could afford it when they used to throw away their money in Harlem. But Negroes can't afford to be taking their money downtown to the white man. Sammy and I, on a robbery job, got a bad scare. A very close call. Things had grown so tight in Harlem that some hustlers had been forced to go to work. Even some prostitutes had gotten jobs as domestics and cleaning office buildings at night. The pimping was so poor, Sammy had gone on the job with me. We'd selected one of those situations considered impossible. But wherever people think that, the guards will unconsciously grow gradually more relaxed until sometimes those can be the easiest jobs of all. But right in the middle of the act, we had some bad luck. A bullet grazed Sammy. We just barely escaped. Sammy, fortunately, wasn't really hurt. We split up, which was always wise to do. Just before daybreak, I went to Sammy's apartment. His newest woman, one of those beautiful but hot-headed Spanish Negroes, was in there crying and carrying on over Sammy. She went for me, screaming and clawing. She knew I'd been in on it with him. I fended her off, not able to figure out why Sammy didn't shut her up. I did. And from the corner of my eye, I saw Sammy going for his gun. Sammy's reaction that way to my hitting his woman, close as he and I were, was the only weak spot I'd ever glimpsed. The woman screamed and dove for him. She knew as I did that when your best friend draws a gun on you, he usually has lost all control of his emotions and he intends to shoot. She distracted Sammy long enough for me to bolt through the door. Sammy chased me, about a block. We soon made up, on the surface. But things never are fully right again with anyone you've seen trying to kill you. Intuition told us that we'd better lay low for a good while. The worst thing was that we'd been seen. The police in that nearby town had surely circulated our general descriptions. I just couldn't forget that incident over Sammy's woman. I came to rely more and more upon my brother Reginald as the only one in my world I could completely trust. Reginald was lazy. I discovered that. He'd quit his hustle altogether. But I didn't mind that, really, because one could be as lazy as he wanted if he would only use his head, as Reginald was doing. He'd left my apartment by now. He was living off his old settler woman when he was in town. I'd also taught Reginald how he could work a little while for a railroad, then use his identification card to travel for nothing. and Reginald loved to travel. Several times he'd gone visiting all around, among our brothers and sisters. They had now begun to scatter to different cities. In Boston, Reginald was closer to our sister Mary than to Ella, who'd been my favorite. Both Reginald and Mary were quiet types, and Ella and I were extroverts. And Shorty in Boston had given my brother a royal time. Because of my reputation, it was easy for me to get into the numbers racket. That was probably Harlem's only hustle which hadn't slumped in business. In return for a favor to some white mobster, my new boss and his wife had just been given a 6 months numbers banking privilege for the Bronx Railroad area called Mott Haven Yards. The white mobsters had the numbers racket split into specific areas. A designated area would be assigned to someone for a specified period of time. My boss's wife had been Dutch Schultz's secretary in the 1930s, during the time when Schultz had strong-armed his way into control of the Harlem numbers business. My job now was to ride a bus across the George Washington Bridge, where a fellow was waiting for me to hand him a bag of numbers betting slips. We never spoke. I'd cross the street and catch the next bus back to Harlem. I never knew who that fellow was. I never knew who picked up the betting money for the slips that I handled. You didn't ask questions in the rackets. My boss's wife and Gladys Hampton were the only two women I ever met in Harlem whose business ability I really respected. My boss's wife, when she had the time and the inclination to talk, would tell me many interesting things. She would talk to me about the Dutch Schultz days, about deals that she'd known, about graft paid to officials, rookie cops and shyster lawyers right on up into the top levels of police and politics. She knew from personal experience how crime existed only to the degree that the law cooperated with it. She showed me how, in the country's entire social, political, and economic structure, the criminal, the law, and the politicians were actually inseparable partners. It was at this time that I changed from my old numbers man, the one I'd used since I first worked in Small's Paradise. He hated to lose a heavy player, but he readily understood why I would now want to play with a runner of my own outfit. That was how I began placing my bets with West Indian Archie. I've mentioned him before, one of Harlem's really bad Negroes, one of those former Dutch Schultz strong-arm men around Harlem. West Indian Archie had finished time in Sing Sing not long before I came to Harlem, but my boss's wife had hired him not just because she knew him from the old days. West Indian Archie had the kind of photographic memory that put him among the elite of numbers runners. He never wrote down your number, even in the case of combination plays. He would just nod. He was able to file all the numbers in his head and write them down for the banker only when he turned in his money. This made him the ideal runner because cops could never catch him with any betting slips. I've often reflected upon such black veteran numbers men as West Indian Archie. If they had lived in another kind of society, their exceptional mathematical talents might have been better used. But they were black. Anyway, it was status just to be known as a client of West Indian Archie's because he handled only sizable bettors. He also required integrity and sound credit. It wasn't necessary that you pay as you played. You could pay West Indian Archie by the week. He always carried a couple of $1,000 on him, his own money. If a client came up to him and said he'd hit for some moderate amount, say a 50-cent or a $1 combination, West Indian Archie would peel off the $300 or $600 and later get his money back from the banker. Every weekend, I'd pay my bill, anywhere from $50 to even $100, if I'd really plunged on some hunch. And when once or twice I did hit, always just some combination, as I've described, West Indian Archie paid me off from his own roll. The 6 months finally ended for my boss and his wife. They'd done well. Their runners got nice tips and promptly were snatched up by other bankers. I continued working for my boss and his wife in a gambling house they opened. A Harlem madam I'd come to know, through having done a friend of hers a favor, introduced me to a special facet of the Harlem night world, something which the riot had only interrupted. It was the world where, behind locked doors, Negroes catered to moneyed white people's weird sexual tastes. The whites I'd known loved to rub shoulders publicly with black folks in the after-hours clubs and speakeasies. These, on the other hand, were whites who did not want it known that they'd been anywhere near Harlem. The riot had made these exclusive white customers nervous. Their slipping into and about Harlem hadn't been so noticeable when other whites were also around, but now they would be conspicuous. They also feared the recently aroused anger of Harlem Negroes. So the madam was safeguarding her growing operation by offering me a steerer's job. During the war, it was extremely difficult to get a telephone. One day, the madam told me to stay at my apartment the next morning. She talked to somebody. I don't know who it was, but before that next noon, I dialed the madam from my own telephone. Unlisted. This madam was a specialist in her field. If her own girls could not, or would not, accommodate a customer, she would send me to another place, usually an apartment somewhere else in Harlem, where the requested specialty was done. My post for picking up the customers was right outside the Astor Hotel, that always busy northwest corner of 45th Street and Broadway. Watching the moving traffic, I was soon able to spot the taxi, car, or limousine, even before it slowed down, with the anxious white faces peering out for the tall, reddish-brown-complexioned Negro wearing a dark suit or raincoat with a white flower in his lapel. If they were in a private car, unless it was chauffeured, I would take the wheel and drive where we were going. But if they were in a taxi, I would always tell the cabbie, "The Apollo Theater in Harlem, please," since among New York City taxis a certain percentage are driven by cops. We would get another cab, driven by a black man, and I'd give him the right address. As soon as I got that party settled, I telephoned the madam. She would generally have me rush by taxi right back downtown to be on the 45th Street and Broadway corner at a specified time. Appointments were strictly punctual. Rarely was I on the corner as much as 5 minutes, and I knew how to keep moving about so as not to attract the attention of any vice squad plainclothes men or uniformed cops. With tips, which were often heavy, sometimes I would make over $100 a night, steering up to 10 customers in a party, to see anything, to do anything, to have anything done to them that they wanted. I hardly ever knew the identities of my customers, but the few I did recognize, or whose names I happened to hear, remind me now of the Profumo case in England. The English are not far ahead of rich and influential Americans when it comes to seeking rarities and oddities. Rich men, middle-aged and beyond, men well past their prime, these weren't college boys. These were their Ivy League fathers, even grandfathers, I guess, society leaders, big politicians, tycoons, important friends from out of town, city government big shots, all kinds of professional people, star performing artists, theatrical and Hollywood celebrities, and, of course, racketeers. Harlem was their sin den, their flesh pot. They stole off among taboo black people and took off whatever antiseptic, important, dignified masks they wore in their white world. These were men who could afford to spend large amounts of money for 2, 3, or 4 hours indulging their strange appetites. But in this black, white, nether world, nobody judged the customers. Anything they could name, anything they could imagine, anything they could describe, they could do or could have done to them, just as long as they paid. In the Profumo case in England, Christine Keeler's friend testified that some of her customers wanted to be whipped. One of my main steers to one specialty address away from the madam's house was the apartment of a big, coal-black girl, strong as an ox, with muscles like a dock worker's. A funny thing, it generally was the oldest of these white men, in their 60s, I know, some maybe in their 70s. They couldn't seem to recover quickly enough from their last whipping, so they could have me meet them again at 45th and Broadway to take them back to that apartment, to cringe on their knees and beg and cry out for mercy under that black girl's whip. Some of them would pay me extra to come and watch them being beaten. That girl greased her big Amazon body all over to look shinier and blacker. She used small, plaited whips. She would draw blood, and she was making herself a small fortune off those old white men. I wouldn't tell all the things I've seen. I used to wonder later on, when I was in prison, what a psychiatrist would make of it all. And so many of these men held responsible positions. They exercised guidance, influence, and authority over others. In prison later, I'd think, too, about another thing. Just about all of those whites specifically expressed as their preference black. Black. The blacker the better. The madam, having long since learned this, had in her house nothing but the blackest accommodating women she could find. In all of my time in Harlem, I never saw a white prostitute touched by a white man. White girls were in some of the various Harlem specialty places. They would participate in customers' most frequent exhibition requests. A sleek, black Negro male having a white woman. Was this the white man wanting to witness his deepest sexual fear? A few times, I even had parties that included white women whom the men had brought with them to watch this. I never steered any white women other than in these instances, brought by their own men or who had been put into contact with me by a white lesbian whom I knew, who was another variety of specialty madam. This lesbian, a beautiful white woman, had a male Negro stable. Her vocabulary was all profanity. She supplied Negro males on order to well-to-do white women. I'd seen this lesbian and her blonde girlfriend around Harlem drinking and talking at bars, always with young Negroes. No one who didn't know would ever guess that the lesbian was recruiting. But one night I gave her and her girlfriend some reefers, which they said were the best they'd ever smoked. They lived in a hotel downtown, and after that, now and then, they would call me, and I would bring them some reefers, and we'd talk. She told me how she'd accidentally gotten started in her specialty. As a Harlem habitué, she had known Harlem Negroes who liked white women. Her role developed from a pattern of talk she often heard from bored, well-to-do white women where she worked, in an East Side beauty salon. Hearing the women complain about sexually inadequate mates, she would tell what she'd heard about Negro men. Observing how excited some of the women seemed to become, she finally arranged some dates with some of the Harlem Negroes she knew at her own apartment. Eventually, she rented 3 midtown apartments where a woman customer could meet a Negro by appointment. Her customers recommended her service to their friends. She quit the beauty salon, set up a messenger service as an operating front, and ran all of her business by telephone. She'd also noticed the color preference. "I never could substitute in an emergency," she would tell me with a laugh, "because I was too light." She told me that nearly every white woman in her clientele would specify a black one. Sometimes they would say a real one, meaning black, no brown Negroes, no red Negroes. The lesbian thought up her messenger service idea because some of her trade wanted the Negroes to come to their homes, at times carefully arranged by telephone. These women lived in neighborhoods of swank brownstones and exclusive apartment houses with doormen dressed like admirals. But white society never thinks about challenging any Negro in a servant role. Doormen would telephone up and hear, "Oh yes, send him right up, James." Service elevators would speed those neatly dressed Negro messenger boys right up so that they could deliver what had been ordered by some of the most privileged white women in Manhattan. The irony is that those white women had no more respect for those Negroes than white men have had for the Negro women they have been using since slavery times. And in turn, Negroes have no respect for the whites they get into bed with. I know the way I felt about Sophia, who still came to New York whenever I called her. The West Indian boyfriend of the Profumo scandal's Christine Keeler, Lucky Gordon, and his friends must have felt the same way. After England's leaders had been with those white girls, those girls, for their satisfaction, went to Negroes to smoke reefers and make fun of some of England's greatest peers as cuckolds and fools. I don't doubt that Lucky Gordon knows the identity of the man in the mask, and much more. If Gordon told everything those white girls told him, he would give England a new scandal. It's no different from what happens in some of America's topmost white circles. 20 years ago, I saw them nightly with my own eyes. I heard them with my own ears. The hypocritical white man will talk about the Negro's low morals. But who has the world's lowest morals, if not whites? And not only that, but the upper-class whites. Recently, details were published about a group of suburban New York City white housewives and mothers operating as a professional call girl ring. In some cases, these wives were out prostituting with the agreement, even the cooperation of husbands, some of whom even waited at home, attending the children. And the customers, to quote a major New York City morning newspaper, "Some 16 ledgers and books with names of 200 Johns, many important social, financial, and political figures, were seized in the raid Friday night." I've also read recently about groups of young white couples who get together. The husbands throw their house keys into a hat. Then, blindfolded, the husbands draw out a key and spend the night with the wife that the house key matches. I have never heard of anything like that being done by Negroes, even Negroes who live in the worst ghettos and alleys and gutters. Early one morning in Harlem, a tall, light Negro wearing a hat and with a woman's stocking drawn down over his face held up a Negro bartender and manager who were counting up the night's receipts. Like most bars in Harlem, Negroes fronted, and a Jew really owned the place. To get a license, one had to know somebody in the state liquor authority, and Jews working with Jews seemed to have the best SLA contacts. The black manager hired some Negro hoodlums to go hunting for the hold-up man, and the man's description caused them to include me among their suspects. About daybreak that same morning, They kicked in the door of my apartment. I told them I didn't know a thing about it, that I hadn't had a thing to do with whatever they were talking about. I told them I'd been out of my hustle, steering, until maybe 4 in the morning, and then I'd come straight to my apartment and gone to bed. The strong-armed thugs were bluffing. They were trying to flush out the man who had done it. They still had other suspects to check out. That's all that saved me. I put on my clothes and took a taxi, and I woke up 2 people, the madam, then Sammy. I had some money, but the madam gave me some more, and I told Sammy I was going to see my brother Filbert in Michigan. I gave Sammy the address so that he could let me know when things got straightened out. This was the trip to Michigan in the wintertime when I put Congoline on my head, then discovered that the bathroom sink's pipes were frozen. To keep the lye from burning up my scalp, I had to stick my head into the stool and flush to rinse out the stuff. A week passed in frigid Michigan before Sammy's telegram came. Another red Negro had confessed, which enabled me to live in Harlem again. But I didn't go back into steering. I can't remember why I didn't. I imagine I must have felt like staying away from hustling for a while, going to some of the clubs at night and narcotizing with my friends. Anyway, I just never went back to the madam's job. It was at about this time, too, I remember, that I began to be sick. I had colds all the time. It got to be a steady irritation, always sniffling and wiping my nose all day, all night. I stayed so high that I was in a dream world. Now, sometimes, I smoked opium with some white friends, actors who lived downtown, and I smoked more reefers than ever before. I didn't smoke the usual wooden match-sized sticks of marijuana. I was so far gone by now that I smoked it almost by the ounce. After a while, I worked downtown for a Jew. He liked me because of something I'd managed to do for him. He bought run-down restaurants and bars. Jaime was his name. He would remodel these places, then stage a big gala reopening with banners and a spotlight outside. The jam-packed, busy place with the big, under new management sign in the window would attract speculators, usually other Jews who were around looking for something to invest money in. Sometimes, even in the week of the new opening, Jaime would resell at a good profit. Jaime really liked me, and I liked him. He loved to talk. I loved to listen. Half his talk was about Jews and Negroes. Jews who had anglicized their names were Jaime's favorite hate. Spitting and curling his mouth in scorn, he would reel off names of people he said had done this. Some of them were famous names who most people never thought of as Jews. "Red, I am a Jew, and you are black," he would say. "These Gentiles don't like either one of us. If the Jew wasn't smarter than the Gentile, he'd get treated worse than your people." Jaime paid me good money while I was with him, sometimes $200 and $300 a week. I would have done anything for Jaime. I did do all kinds of things. But my main job was transporting bootleg liquor that Jaime supplied, usually to those spruced-up bars which he'd sold to someone. Another fellow and I would drive out to Long Island where a big bootleg whiskey outfit operated. We'd take with us cartons of empty, bonded whiskey bottles that were saved illegally by bars we supplied. We would buy 5-gallon containers of bootleg, funnel it into the bottles, then deliver, according to Jaime's instructions, this or that many crates back to the bars. Many people claiming they drank only such and such a brand couldn't tell their only brand from pure, week-old Long Island bootleg. Most ordinary whiskey drinkers are brand chumps like this. On the side, with Jaime's approval, I was myself at that time supplying some lesser quantities of bootleg to reputable Harlem bars, as well as to some of the few speakeasies still in Harlem. But one weekend on Long Island, something happened involving the state liquor authority. One of New York State's biggest recent scandals has been the exposure of wholesale SLA graft and corruption. In the bootleg racket I was involved in, someone high up must have been taken for a real pile. A rumor about some inside tipster spread among Jaime and the others. One day, Jaime didn't show up where he told me to meet him. I never heard from him again. But I did hear that he was put in the ocean, and I knew he couldn't swim. Up in the Bronx, a Negro held up some Italian racketeers in a floating crap game. I heard about it on the wire. Whoever did it, aside from being a fool, was said to be a tall, light-skinned Negro, masked with a woman's stocking. It has always made me wonder if that bar stick-up had really been solved, or if the wrong man had confessed under beatings. But anyway, the past suspicion of me helped to revive suspicion of me again. Up in Fat Man's bar on the hill overlooking the polo grounds, I'd just gone into a telephone booth. Everyone in the bar, all over Harlem, in fact, was drinking up, excited about the news that Branch Rickey, the Brooklyn Dodgers owner, had just signed Jackie Robinson to play in Major League Baseball with the Dodgers farm team in Montreal, which would place the time in the fall of 1945. Early in the afternoon, I'd collected from West Indian Archie for a 50-cent combination bet. He'd paid me $300 right out of his pocket. I was telephoning Jean Parks. Jean was one of the most beautiful women who ever lived in Harlem. She once sang with Sarah Vaughan in the Bluebonnets, a quartet that sang with Earl Hines. For a long time, Jean and I had enjoyed a standing, friendly deal that we'd go out and celebrate when either of us hit the numbers. Since my last hit, Jean had treated me twice, and we laughed on the phone, glad that now I'd treat her to a night out. We arranged to go to a 52nd Street nightclub to hear Billie Holiday, who had been on the road and was just back in New York. As I hung up, I spotted the two lean, tough-looking paisanos gazing in at me cooped up in the booth. I didn't need any intuition, and I had no gun. A cigarette case was the only thing in my pocket. I started easing my hand down into my pocket to try bluffing, and one of them snatched open the door. They were dark, olive, swarthy-featured Italians. I had my hand down into my pocket. "Come on outside. We'll hold court," one said. At that moment, a cop walked through the front door. The two thugs slipped out. I never in my life have been so glad to see a cop. I was still shaking when I got to the apartment of my friend Sammy the Pimp. He told me that not long before, West Indian Archie had been there looking for me. Sometimes, recalling all of this, I don't know, to tell the truth, how I'm alive to tell it today. They say God takes care of fools and babies. I've so often thought that Allah was watching over me. Through all of this time of my life, I really was dead. Mentally dead. I just didn't know that I was. Anyway, to kill time, Sammy and I sniffed some of his cocaine until the time came to pick up Jean Parks to go down to hear Lady Day. Sammy's having told me about West Indian Archie looking for me didn't mean a thing. Not right then. Chapter 8. Trapped. There was the knocking at the door. Sammy, lying on his bed in pajamas and a bathrobe, called, "Who?" When West Indian Archie answered, Sammy slid the round, two-sided shaving mirror under the bed with what little of the cocaine powder, or crystals, actually, was left, and I opened the door. "Red, I want my money." A .32-20 is a funny kind of gun. It's bigger than a .32, but it's not as big as a .38. I had faced down some dangerous Negroes, but no one who wasn't ready to die messed with West Indian Archie. I couldn't believe it. He truly scared me. I was so incredulous at what was happening that it was hard to form words with my brain in my mouth. "Man, what's the beef?" West Indian Archie said he'd thought I was trying something when I told him I'd hit, but he paid me the $300 until he could double-check his written betting slips, and as he thought, I hadn't combinated the number I'd claimed, but another. "Man, you're crazy." I talked fast. I'd seen out of the corner of my eye Sammy's hand easing under his pillow where he kept his Army 45. "Archie's smarter man as you're supposed to be. You'd pay somebody who hadn't hit." The 30-20 moved, and Sammy froze. West Indian Archie told him, "I ought to shoot you through the ear." And he looked back at me. "You don't have my money?" I must have shaken my head. "I'll give you until 12 o'clock tomorrow." And he put his hand behind him and pulled open the door. He backed out and slammed it. It was a classic hustler code impasse. The money wasn't the problem. I still had about $200 of it. Had money been the issue, Sammy could have made up the difference. If it wasn't in his pocket, his women could quickly have raised it. West Indian Archie himself, for that matter, would have loaned me $300 if I'd ever asked him, as many thousands of dollars of mine as he'd gotten 10% of. Once, in fact, when he'd heard I was broke, he had looked me up and handed me some money and grunted, "Stick this in your pocket." The issue was the position which his action had put us both into. For a hustler in our sidewalk jungle world, face and honor were important. No hustler could have it known that he'd been hyped, meaning outsmarted or made a fool of. And worse, a hustler could never afford to have it demonstrated that he could be bluffed, that he could be frightened by a threat, that he lacked nerve. West Indian Archie knew that some young hustlers rose in stature in our world when they somehow hoodwinked older hustlers, then put it on the wire for everyone to hear. He believed I was trying that. In turn, I knew he would be protecting his stature by broadcasting all over the wire his threat to me. Because of this code, in my time in Harlem, I'd personally known a dozen hustlers who threatened, left town, disgraced. Once the wire had it, any retreat by either of us was unthinkable. The wire would be awaiting the report of the showdown. I'd also known of at least another dozen showdowns in which one took the dead-on-arrival ride to the morgue, and the other went to prison for manslaughter or the electric chair for murder. Sammy let me hold his .32. My guns were at my apartment. I put the .32 in my pocket with my hand on it and walked out. I couldn't stay out of sight. I had to show up at all of my usual haunts. I was glad that Reginald was out of town. He might have tried protecting me, and I didn't want him shot in the head by West Indian Archie. I stood a while in the corner, with my mind confused, the muddled thinking that's characteristic of the addict. Was West Indian Archie, I began to wonder, bluffing a hype on me? To make fun of me? Some old hustlers did love to hype younger ones. I knew he wouldn't do it as some would, just to pick up $300, but everyone was so slick. In this Harlem jungle, people would hype their brothers. Numbers runners often had hyped addicts who had hit, who were so drugged that when challenged, they really couldn't be sure if they played a certain number. I began to wonder whether West Indian Archie might not be right. Had I really gotten my combination confused? I certainly knew the two numbers I'd played. I knew I'd told him to combinate only one of them. Had I gotten mixed up about which number? Have you ever been so sure you did something that you never would have thought of it again, unless it was brought up again? Then you start trying to mentally confirm, and you're only about half sure. It was just about time for me to go and pick up Gene Parks to go downtown to see Billy at the Onyx Club. So much was swirling in my head. I thought about telephoning her and calling it off, making some excuse. But I knew that running now was the worst thing I could do. So I went on and picked up Gene at her place. We took a taxi on down to 52nd Street. Billie Holiday. And those big photo blow-ups of her were under the lights outside. Inside, the tables were jammed against the wall. Tables about big enough to get two drinks and four elbows on. The Onyx was one of those very little places. Billie, at the microphone, had just finished a number when she saw Gene and me. A white gown glittered under the spotlight. Her face had that coppery, Indianish look, and her hair was in that trademark ponytail. For her next number, she did the one she knew I always liked so. You don't know what love is. Until you face each dawn with sleepless eyes. Until you've lost a love you hate to lose. When our set was done, Billie came over to our table. She and Gene, who hadn't seen each other in a long time, hugged each other. Billie sensed something wrong with me. She knew that I was always high, but she knew me well enough to see that something else was wrong, and asked in her customary profane language what was the matter with me. And in my own foul vocabulary of those days, I pretended to be without a care, so she let it drop. We had a picture taken by the club photographer that night. The three of us were sitting close together. That was the last time I ever saw Lady Day. She's dead. Dope and heartbreak stopped that heart as big as a barn. And that sound and style that no one successfully copies. Lady Day sang with the soul of Negroes from the centuries of sorrow and oppression. What a shame that proud, fine black woman never lived where the true greatness of the black race was appreciated. In the Onyx Club men's room, I sniffed the little packet of cocaine I'd gotten from Sammy. Jean and I, riding back up to Harlem in a cab, decided to have another drink. She had no idea what was happening when she suggested one of my main hangouts, the bar of the Lamar Cherie on the corner of 147th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue. I had my gun and the cocaine courage, and I said okay. And by the time we'd had the drink, I was so high that I asked Jean to take a cab on home, and she did. I never have seen Jean again, either. Like a fool, I didn't leave the bar. I stayed there sitting like a bigger fool with my back to the door thinking about West Indian Archie. Since that day, I have never sat with my back to a door, and I never will again. But it's a good thing I was then. I'm positive if I'd seen West Indian Archie come in, I'd have shot to kill. The next thing I knew, West Indian Archie was standing before me, cursing me, loud, his gun on me. He was really making his public point, floor showing for the people. He called me foul names, threatened me. Everyone, bartenders and customers, sat or stood as though carved, drinks in midair. The jukebox in the rear was going. I'd never seen West Indian Archie high before. Not a whiskey high. I could tell it was something else. I knew the hustler's characteristic of keying up on dope to do a job. I was thinking, I'm going to kill Archie. I'm just going to wait until he turns around to get the drop on him. I could feel my own .32 resting against my ribs where it was tucked under my belt, beneath my coat. West Indian Archie, seeming to read my mind, quit cursing, and his words jarred me. You're thinking you're going to kill me first, Red? But I'm going to give you something to think about. I'm 60. I'm an old man. I've been to Sing Sing. My life is over. You're a young man. Kill me. You're lost anyway. All you can do is go to prison. I've since thought that West Indian Archie may have been trying to scare me into running to save both his face and his life. And maybe that's why he was high. No one knew that I hadn't killed anyone. But no one who knew me, including myself, would doubt that I'd kill. I can't guess what might have happened. But under the code, if West Indian Archie had gone out of the door after having humiliated me as he had, I'd have had to follow him out. We'd have shot it out in the street. But some friends of West Indian Archie moved up alongside him, quietly calling his name, Archie, Archie. And he let them put their hands on him, and they drew him aside. I watched them move him past where I was sitting, glaring at me. They were working him back toward the rear. Then, taking my time, I got down off the stool. I dropped a bill on the bar for the bartender. Without looking back, I went out. I stood outside in full view of the bar with my hand in my pocket for perhaps 5 minutes. When West Indian Archie didn't come out, I left. It must have been 5 in the morning when downtown I woke up a white actor I knew who lived in the Howard Hotel on 45th Street off 6th Avenue. I knew I had to stay high. The amount of dope I put into myself within the next several hours sounds inconceivable. I got some opium from that fellow. I took a cab back up to my apartment, and I smoked it. My gun was ready if I heard a mosquito cough. My telephone rang. It was the white lesbian who lived downtown. She wanted me to bring her and her girlfriend $50 worth of reefers. I felt that if I'd always done it, I had to do it now. Opium had me drowsy. I had a bottle of Benzedrine tablets in my bathroom. I swallowed some of them to perk up. The two drugs working in me had my head going in opposite directions at the same time. I knocked at the apartment right behind mine. The dealer let me have loose marijuana on credit. He saw I was so high that he even helped me to roll it, 100 sticks. And while we were rolling it, we both smoked some. Now opium, Benzedrine, reefers. I stopped by Sammy's on the way downtown. His flashing-eyed Spanish Negro woman opened the door. Sammy had gotten weak for that woman. He never let any other of his women hang around so much. Now she was even answering his doorbell. Sammy was by this time very badly addicted. He seemed hardly to recognize me. Lying in bed, he reached under and again brought out that inevitable shaving mirror on which, for some reason, he always kept his cocaine crystals. He motioned for me to sniff some. I didn't refuse. Going downtown to deliver the reefers, I felt sensations I cannot describe in all those different grooves at the same time. The only word to describe it was a timelessness. A day might have seemed to be 5 minutes, or a half hour might have seemed a week. I can't imagine how I looked when I got to the hotel. When the lesbian and her girlfriend saw me, they helped me to a bed. I fell across it and passed out. That night, when they woke me up, it was half a day beyond West Indian Archie's deadline. Late, I went back uptown. It was on the wire. I could see people who knew me finding business elsewhere. I knew nobody wanted to be caught in a crossfire. But nothing happened the next day either. I just stayed high. Some raw kid hustled in a bar. I had to bust in his mouth. He came back pulling a blade. I would have shot him, but somebody grabbed him. They put him out, cursing that he was going to kill me. Intuition told me to get rid of my gun. I gave a hustler the eye across the bar. I no more than slipped him the gun from my belt when a cop I'd seen about came in the other door. He had his hand on his gun butt. He knew what was all over the wire. He was certain I'd be armed. He came slowly over toward me, and I knew if I sneezed, he'd blast me down. He said, "Take your hand out of your pocket, Red. Real carefully." I did. Once he saw me empty-handed, we both could relax a little. He motioned for me to walk outside ahead of him, and I did. His partner was waiting on the sidewalk opposite their patrol car, double-parked with its radio going. With people stopping, looking, they patted me down there on the sidewalk. "What are you looking for?" I asked them when they didn't find anything. "Red, there's a report you're carrying a gun." "I had one," I said, "but I threw it in the river." The one who had come into the bar said, "I think I'd leave town if I were you, Red." I went back into the bar. Saying that I'd thrown my gun away had kept them from taking me to my apartment. Things I had there could have got me more time than 10 guns, and could have gotten them a promotion. Everything was building up, closing in on me. I was trapped in so many cross turns. West Indian Archie gunning for me, the Italians who thought I'd stuck up their crap game after me, the scared kid hustler I'd hit, the cops. For 4 years up to that point, I've been lucky enough or slick enough to escape jail or even getting arrested or any serious trouble. But I knew that any minute now, something had to give. Sammy had done something that I'd often wished I could have thanked him for. When I heard the car's horn, I was walking on St. Nicholas Avenue, but my ears were hearing a gun. I didn't dream the horn could possibly be for me. "Homeboy!" I jerked around. I came close to shooting. Shorty, from Boston. I'd scared him nearly to death. "Daddy-o!" I couldn't have been happier. Inside the car, he told me Sammy had telephoned about how I was jammed up tight and told him he'd better come and get me. And Shorty did his band's date, then borrowed his piano man's car and burned up the miles to New York. I didn't put up any objections to leaving. Shorty stood watch outside my apartment. I brought out and stuffed into the car's trunk what little stuff I cared to hang on to. Then we hit the highway. Shorty had been without sleep for about 36 hours. He told me afterward that through just about the whole ride back, I talked out of my head. Chapter 9. Caught. Ella couldn't believe how atheist, how uncouth I'd become. I believed that a man should do anything that he was slick enough or bad and bold enough to do, and that a woman was nothing but another commodity. Every word I spoke was hip or profane. I would bet that my working vocabulary wasn't 200 words. Even Shorty, whose apartment I now again shared, wasn't prepared for how I lived and thought, like a predatory animal. Sometimes I would catch him watching me. At first, I slept a lot, even at night. I'd slept mostly in the daytime during the preceding 2 years. When awake, I smoked reefers. Shorty had originally introduced me to marijuana, and my consumption of it now astounded him. I didn't want to talk much at first. When awake, I'd play records continuously. The reefers gave me a feeling of contentment. I would enjoy hours of floating, daydreaming, imaginary conversations with my New York musician friends. Within 2 weeks, I'd had more sleep than during any 2 months when I'd been in Harlem, hustling day and night. When I finally went out in the Roxbury streets, it took me only a little while to locate a peddler of snow, cocaine. It was when I got back into that familiar snow feeling that I began to want to talk. Cocaine produces, for those who sniff its powdery white crystals, an illusion of supreme well-being and a soaring overconfidence in both physical and mental ability. You think you could whip the heavyweight champion and that you are smarter than everybody. There was also that feeling of timelessness, and there were intervals of ability to recall and review things that had happened years back with an astonishing clarity. Shorty's band played at spots around Boston 3 or 4 nights a week. After he left for work, Sophia would come over and I'd talk about my plans. She would be gone back to her husband by the time Shorty returned from work, and I'd bend his ear until daybreak. Sophia's husband had gotten out of the military, and he was some sort of salesman. He was supposed to have a big deal going, which soon would require his traveling a lot to the West Coast. I didn't ask questions, but Sophia often indicated they weren't doing too well. I know I had nothing to do with that. He never dreamed I existed. A white woman might blow up at her husband and scream and yell and call him every name she can think of and say the most vicious things in an effort to hurt him and talk about his mother and his grandmother, too. But one thing she never will tell him herself is that she's going with a black man. That's one automatic red murder flag to the white man, and his woman knows it. Sophia always had given me money. Even when I had hundreds of dollars in my pocket, when she came to Harlem, I would take everything she had, short of her train fare back to Boston. It seems that some women love to be exploited. When they're not exploited, they exploit the man. Anyway, it was his money that she gave me, I guess, because she never had worked. But now my demands on her increased, and she came up with more. Again, I don't know where she got it. Always, every now and then, I'd given her a hard time just to keep her in line. Every once in a while, a woman seems to need, in fact, wants this, too. But now I would feel evil and slap her around worse than ever some of the nights when Shorty was away. She would cry, curse me, and swear that she would never be back. But I knew she wasn't even thinking about not coming back. Sophia's being around was one of Shorty's greatest pleasures about my homecoming. I've said it before. I never in my life have seen a black man that desired white women as sincerely as Shorty did. Since I'd known him, he had several. He'd never been able to keep a white woman any length of time, though, because he was too good to them. And as I've said, any woman, white or black, seems to get bored with that. It happened that Shorty was between white women when one night Sophia brought to the house her 17-year-old sister. I never saw anything like the way that she and Shorty nearly jumped for each other. For him, she wasn't only a white girl, but a young white girl. For her, he wasn't only a Negro, but a Negro musician. In look, she was a younger version of Sophia, who still turned heads. Sometimes I take the two girls to Negro places where Shorty played. Negroes showed 32 teeth apiece as soon as they saw the white girls. They would come over to your booth or your table. They would stand there and drool. And Shorty was no better. He'd stand up there playing and watching that young girl waiting for him and waving at him and winking. As soon as the set was over, he'd practically run over people getting down to our table. I didn't Lindy Hop anymore now. I wouldn't even have thought of it now, just as I wouldn't have been caught in a zoot suit now. All of my suits were conservative. A banker might have worn my shoes. I met Laura again. We were really glad to see each other. She was a lot more like me now. A good time girl. We talked and laughed. She looked a lot older than she really was. She had no one man. She freelanced around. She had long since moved away from her grandmother. Laura told me she'd finished school, but then she gave up the college idea. Laura was high whenever I saw her now, too. We smoked some reefers together. After about a month of laying dead, as inactivity was called, I knew I had to get some kind of hustle going. A hustler broke needs a stake. Some nights when Shorty was playing, I would take whatever Sophia had been able to get for me, and I'd try to run it up into something playing stud poker at John Hughes's gambling house. When I lived in Roxbury before, John Hughes had been a big gambler who wouldn't have spoken to me. But during the war, the Roxbury Wire had carried a lot about things I was doing in Harlem, and now the New York name magic was on me. That was the feeling that hustlers everywhere else had. If you could hustle and make it in New York, they were well off to know you. It gave them prestige. Anyway, through the same flush war years, John Hughes had hustled profitably enough to be able to open a pretty good gambling house. John one night was playing in a game I was in. After the first two cards were dealt around the table, I had an ace showing. I looked beneath it at my whole card. Another ace. A pair, back to back. My ace showing made it my turn to bet. But I didn't rush. I sat there and studied. Finally, I knocked my knuckles on the table, passing, leaving the betting to the next man. My action implied that beneath my ace was some nothing card that I didn't care to risk my money on. The player sitting next to me took the bait. He bet pretty heavily, and the next man raised him. Possibly each of them had small pairs. Maybe they just wanted to scare me out before I drew another ace. Finally, the bet reached John, who had a queen showing. He raised everybody. Now there was no telling what John had. John truly was a clever gambler. He could gamble as well as anybody I'd gambled with in New York. So the bet came back to me. It was going to cost me a lot of money to call all the raises. Some of them obviously had good cards, but I knew I had every one of them beat. But again, I studied and studied. I pretended perplexity. And finally, I put in my money, calling the bets. The same betting pattern went on with each new card, right around to the last card. And when that last card went around, I hit another ace in sight. Three aces. And John hit another queen in sight. He bet a pile. Now everyone else studied a long time. And one by one, all folded their hands. Except me. All I could do was put what I had left on the table. If I'd had the money, I could have raised $500 or more, and he'd have had to call me. John couldn't have gone the rest of his life wondering if I had bluffed him out of a pot that big. I showed my whole card ace. John had three queens. As I hauled in the pot, something over $500, my first real stake in Boston, John got up from the table. He'd quit. He told his houseman, "Any time Red comes in here and wants anything, let him have it," he said. "I've never seen a young man play his whole card like he played." John said, "young man," being himself about 50, I guess, although you can never be certain about a Negro's age. He thought, as most people would have, that I was about 30. No one in Roxbury except my sisters Ella and Mary suspected my real age. The story of that poker game helped my on-scene reputation among the other gamblers and hustlers around Roxbury. Another thing that happened in John's gambling house contributed. The incident that made it known that I carried not a gun, but some guns. John had a standing rule that anyone who came into the place to gamble had to check his guns if he had any. I always checked two guns. Then one night when a gambler tried to pull something slick, I drew a third gun from its shoulder holster. This added to the rest of my reputation the word that I was trigger-happy and crazy. Looking back, I think I really was at least slightly out of my mind. I viewed narcotics as most people regard food. I wore my guns as today I wear my neckties. Deep down, I actually believed that after living as fully as humanly possible, one should then die violently. I expected then, as I still expect today, to die at any time. But then, I think I deliberately invited death in many, sometimes insane ways. For instance, a merchant marine sailor who knew me and my reputation came into a bar carrying a package. He motioned me to follow him downstairs into the men's room. He unwrapped a stolen machine gun. He wanted to sell it. I said, "How do I know it works?" He loaded it with a cartridge clip and told me that all I would have to do then was squeeze the trigger release. I took the gun, examined it, and the first thing he knew I had it jammed right up in his belly. I told him I would blow him wide open. He went backwards out of the restroom and up the stairs the way Bill Bojangles Robinson used to dance going backwards. He knew I was crazy enough to kill him. I was insane enough not to consider that he might just wait his chance to kill me. For perhaps a month I kept the machine gun at Shorty's before I was broke and sold it. When Reginald came to Roxbury visiting, he was shocked at what he'd found out upon returning to Harlem. I spent some time with him. He still was the kid brother whom I still felt more family toward than I felt now even for our sister Ella. Ella still liked me. I would go to see her once in a while, but Ella had never been able to reconcile herself to the way I had changed. She has since told me that she had a steady foreboding that I was on my way into big trouble. But I always had the feeling that Ella somehow admired my rebellion against the world, because she, who had so much more drive and guts than most men, often felt stymied by having been born female. Had I been thinking only in terms of myself, maybe I would have chosen steady gambling as a hustle. There were enough chump gamblers that hung around John Hughes for a good gambler to make a living off them. Chumps that worked, usually. One would just have to never miss the games on their paydays. Besides, John Hughes had offered me a job dealing for games. I didn't want that. But I'd come around to thinking not only of myself. I wanted to get something going that could help Shorty, too. We'd been talking. I really felt sorry for Shorty. The same old musician story. The so-called glamour of being a musician, earning just about enough money so that after he paid rent and bought his reefers and food and other routine things, he had nothing left. Plus debts. How could Shorty have anything? I'd spent years in Harlem and on the road around the most popular musicians. The names, even, who really were making big money for musicians. And they had nothing. For that matter, all the thousands of dollars I'd handled. And I had nothing. Just satisfying my cocaine habit alone cost me about $20 a day. I guess another $5 a day could have been added for reefers and plain tobacco cigarettes that I smoked. Besides getting high on drugs, I chain-smoked as many as 4 packs a day. And if you ask me today, I'll tell you that tobacco, in all its forms, is just as much an addiction as any narcotic. When I opened the subject of a hustle with Shorty, I started by first bringing him to agree with my concept, of which he was a living proof, that only squares kept on believing they could ever get anything by slaving. And when I mentioned what I had in mind, house burglary, Shorty, who always had been so relatively conservative, really surprised me by how quickly he agreed. He didn't even know anything about burglarizing. When I began to explain how it was done, Shorty wanted to bring in this friend of his, whom I had met and liked, called Rudy. Rudy's mother was Italian. His father was a Negro. He was born right there in Boston, a short, light fellow, a pretty boy type. Rudy worked regularly for an employment agency that sent him to wait on tables at exclusive parties. He had a side deal going, a hustle that took me right back to the old steering days in Harlem. Once a week, Rudy went to the home of this old, rich Boston blue blood, pillar of society, aristocrat. He paid Rudy to undress them both, then pick up the old man like a baby, lay him on his bed, then stand over him and sprinkle him all over with talcum powder. Rudy said the old man would actually reach his climax from that. I told him and Shorty about some of the things I'd seen. Rudy said that as far as he knew, Boston had no organized specialty sex houses, just individual rich whites who had their private specialty desires catered to by Negroes who came to their homes camouflaged as chauffeurs, maids, waiters, or some other accepted image. Just as in New York, these were the rich, the highest society. The predominantly old men past the age of ability to conduct any kind of ordinary sex, always hunting for new ways to be sensitive. Rudy, I remember, spoke of one old white man who paid a black couple to let him watch them have intercourse on his bed. Another was so sensitive that he paid to sit on a chair outside a room where a couple was. He got his satisfaction just from imagining what was going on inside. A good burglary team includes, I knew, what is called a finder. A finder is one who locates lucrative places to rob. Another principal need is someone able to case these places' physical layouts to determine means of entry, the best getaway routes, and so forth. Rudy qualified on both counts. Being sent to work in rich homes, he wouldn't be suspected when he sized up their loot and cased the joint, just running around looking busy with a white coat on. Rudy's reaction when he was told what we had in mind was something I remember like, "Man, when do we start?" But I wasn't rushing off half-cocked. I'd learned from some of the pros and from my own experience how important it was to be careful and plan. Burglary, properly executed, though it had its dangers, offered the maximum chances of success with the minimum risk. If you did your job so that you never met any of your victims, it first lessened your chances of having to attack or perhaps kill someone. And if through some slip-up you were caught, later by the police, there was never a positive eyewitness. It is also important to select an area of burglary and stick to that. There are specific specialties among burglars. Some work apartments only, others houses only, others stores only, or warehouses. Still others will go after only safes or strong boxes. Within the residence burglary category, there are further specialty distinctions. There are the day burglars, the dinner and theater time burglars, the night burglars. I think that any city's police will tell you that very rarely do they find one type who will work at another time. For instance, Jump Steady in Harlem was a nighttime apartment specialist. It would have been hard to persuade Jump Steady to work in the daytime if a millionaire had gone out for lunch and left his front door wide open. I had one very practical reason never to work in the daytime, aside from my inclinations. With my high visibility, I'd have been sunk in the daytime. I could just hear people. A reddish-brown Negro over 6 feet tall. One glance would be enough. Setting up what I wanted to be the perfect operation, I thought about pulling the white girls into it for two reasons. One was that I realized we'd be too limited relying only upon places where Rudy worked as a waiter. He didn't get to work in too many places. It wouldn't be very long before we ran out of sources. And when other places had to be found and cased in the rich, white residential areas, Negroes hanging around would stick out like sore thumbs. But these white girls could get invited into the right places. I disliked the idea of having too many people involved, all at the same time. But with Shorty and Sophia's sister so close now, and Sophia and me as though we had been together for 50 years, and Rudy as eager and cool as he was, nobody would be apt to spill. Everybody would be under the same risk. We would be like a family unit. I never doubted that Sophia would go along. Sophia would do anything I said. And her sister would do anything that Sophia said. They both went for it. Sophia's husband was away on one of his trips to the coast when I told her and her sister. Most burglars I knew were caught not on the job, but trying to dispose of the loot. Finding the fence we used was a rare piece of luck. We agreed upon the plan for operations. The fence didn't work with us directly. He had a representative, an ex-con who dealt with me, and no one else in my gang. Aside from his regular business, he owned around Boston several garages and small warehouses. The arrangement was that before a job, I would alert the representative and give him a general idea of what we expected to get, and he'd tell me at which garage or warehouse we should make the drop. After we'd made our drop, the representative would examine the stolen articles. He would remove all identifying marks from everything. Then he would call the fence, who would come and make a personal appraisal. The next day, the representative would meet me at a prearranged place and would make the payment for what we had stolen, in cash. One thing I remember, this fence always sent your money in crisp, brand new bills. He was smart. Somehow that had a very definite psychological effect upon all of us, after we'd pulled a job, walking around with that crisp, green money in our pockets. He may have had other reasons. We needed a base of operations, not in Roxbury. The girls rented an apartment in Harvard Square. Unlike Negroes, these white girls could go shopping for the locale and physical situation we wanted. It was on the ground floor where, moving late at night, all of us could come and go without attracting notice. In any organization, someone must be the boss. If it's even just one person. You've got to be the boss of yourself. At our gang's first meeting in the apartment, we discussed how we were going to work. The girls would get into houses to case them by ringing bells and saying they were saleswomen, poll takers, college girls making a survey, or anything else suitable. Once in the houses, they would get around as much as they could without attracting attention. Then, back, they would report what special valuables they had seen and where. They would draw the layout for Shorty, Rudy, and me. We agreed that the girls would actually burglarize only in special cases where there would be some advantage. But generally, the three men would go. Two of us to do the job, while the third kept watching the getaway car with the motor running. Talking to them, laying down the plans, I deliberately sat on a bed away from them. All of a sudden, I pulled out my gun, shook out all five bullets, and then let them see me put back only one bullet. I twirled the cylinder and put the muzzle to my head. "Now I'm going to see how much guts all of you have," I said. I grinned at them. All of their mouths had flapped open. I pulled the trigger. We all heard it. Click. "I'm going to do it again now." They begged me to stop. I could see in Shorty's and Rudy's eyes some idea of rushing me. We all heard the hammer click on another empty cylinder. The women were in hysterics. Rudy and Shorty were begging, "Man, Red, cut it out, man, freeze." I pulled the trigger once more. "I'm doing this, showing you I'm not afraid to die," I told them. "Never cross a man not afraid to die. Now let's get to work." I never had one moment's trouble with any of them after that. Sophia acted awed. Her sister all but called me Mr. Red. Shorty and Rudy were never again quite the same with me. Neither of them ever mentioned it. They thought I was crazy. They were afraid of me. We pulled the first job that night. The place of the old man who hired Rudy to sprinkle him with talcum powder. A cleaner job couldn't have been asked for. Everything went like clockwork. The fence was full of praise. He proved he meant it with his crisp, new money. The old man later told Rudy how a small army of detectives had been there, and they decided that the job had the earmarks of some gang which had been operating around Boston for about a year. We quickly got it down to a science. The girls would scout and case in wealthy neighborhoods. The burglary would be pulled. Sometimes it took no more than 10 minutes. Shorty and I did most of the actual burglary. Rudy generally had the getaway car. If the people weren't at home, we'd use a passkey on a common door lock. On a patent lock, we'd use a jimmy, as it's called, or a lock pick. Or sometimes we would enter by windows from a fire escape or a roof. Gullible women often took the girls all over their houses, just to hear them exclaiming over the finery. With the help of the girls' drawings and a finger beam searchlight, we went straight to the things we wanted. Sometimes the victims were in their beds asleep. That may sound very daring. Actually, it was almost easy. The first thing we had to do when people were in the house was to wait, very still, and pick up the sounds of breathing. Snorers we loved. They made it real easy. In stockinged feet, we'd go right into the bedrooms. Moving swiftly, like shadows, we would lift clothes, watches, wallets, handbags, and jewelry boxes. The Christmas season was Santa Claus for us. People had expensive presents lying all over their houses, and they'd taken more cash than usual out of their banks. Sometimes, working earlier than we usually did, we even worked houses that we hadn't cased. If the shades were drawn full and no lights were on, and there was no answer when one of the girls rang the bell, we would take the chance and go in. I can give you a very good tip if you want to keep burglars out of your house. A light on for the burglar to see is the very best single means of protection. One of the ideal things is to leave a bathroom light on all night. The bathroom is one place where somebody could be for any length of time, at any time of the night, and he would be likely to hear the slightest strange sound. The burglar, knowing this, won't try to enter. It's also the cheapest possible protection. The kilowatts are a lot cheaper than your valuables. We became efficient. The fence sometimes relayed tips as to where we could find good loot. It was in this way that for one period, one of our best periods, I remember, we specialized in Oriental rugs. I've always suspected that the fence himself sold the rugs to the people we stole them from. But anyway, you wouldn't imagine the value of those things. I remember one small one that brought us $1,000. There's no telling what the fence got for it. Every burglar knew that fences robbed the burglars worse than the burglars had robbed the victims. Our only close brush with the law came once when we were making our getaway, three of us in the front seat of the car, and the back seat loaded with stuff. Suddenly we saw a police car around the corner, coming toward us, and it went on past us. They were just cruising. But then in the rear-view mirror, we saw them make a U-turn, and we knew they were going to flash us to stop. They had spotted us in passing as Negroes, and they knew that Negroes had no business in the area at that hour. It was a close situation. There was a lot of robbery going on. We weren't the only gang working. We knew not by any means. But I knew that the white man is rare who will ever consider that a Negro can outsmart him. Before their light began flashing, I told Rudy to stop. I did what I'd done once before. Got out and flagged them, walking toward them. When they stopped, I was at their car. I asked them, bumbling my words like a confused Negro, if they could tell me how to get to a Roxbury address. They told me, and we, and they, went on about our respective businesses. We were going along fine. We'd make a good pile and then lay low a while, living it up. Shorty still played with his band. Rudy never missed attending his sensitive old man, or the table waiting at his exclusive parties, and the girls maintained their routine home schedules. Sometimes I still took the girls out to places where Shorty played and to other places, spending money as though it were going out of style, the girls dressed in jewelry and furs they had selected from our halls. No one knew our hustle, but it was clear that we were doing fine. And sometimes the girls would come over and we'd meet them either at Shorty's in Roxbury or in our Harvard Square place and just smoke reefers and play music. It's a shame to tell on a man. But Shorty was so obsessed with the white girl that even if the lights were out, he would pull up the shade to be able to see that white flesh by the street lamp from outside. Early evenings, when we were laying low between jobs, I often went to a Massachusetts Avenue nightclub called the Savoy. And Sevilla would telephone me there punctually. Even when we pulled jobs, I would leave from this club, then rush back there after the job. The reason was so that if it was ever necessary, people could testify that they had seen me at just about the time the job was pulled. Negroes being questioned by policemen would be very hard to pin down on any exact time. Boston at this time had two Negro detectives. Ever since I'd come back on the Roxbury scene, one of these detectives, a dark brown fellow named Turner, had never been able to stand me, and it was mutual. He talked about what he would do to me, and I had promptly put an answer back on the wire. I knew from the way he began to act that he'd heard it. Everyone knew that I carried guns, and he did have sense enough to know that I wouldn't hesitate to use them, and on him, detective or not. This early evening I was in this place when, at the usual time, the phone in the booth rang. It rang just as this detective Turner happened to walk in through the front door. He saw me start to get up. He knew the call was for me, but stepped inside the booth and answered. I heard him saying, looking straight at me, "Hello? Hello? Hello?" And I knew that Sophia, taking no chances with a strange voice, had hung up. "Wasn't that call for me?" I asked Turner. He said that it was. I said, "Well, why didn't you say so?" He gave me a rude answer. I knew he wanted me to make a move first. We both were being cagey. We both knew that we wanted to kill each other. Neither wanted to say the wrong thing. Turner didn't want to say anything that, repeated, would make him sound bad. I didn't want to say anything that could be interpreted as a threat to a cop. But I remember exactly what I said to him anyway, purposely loud enough for some people at the bar to hear me. I said, "You know, Turner, you're trying to make history. Don't you know that if you play with me, you certainly will go down in history, because you've got to kill me?" Turner looked at me. Then he backed down. He walked on by me. I guess he wasn't ready to make history. I'd gotten to the point where I was walking on my own coffin. It's a law of the rackets that every criminal expects to get caught. He tries to stave off the inevitable for as long as he can. Drugs helped me push the thought to the back of my mind. They were the center of my life. I'd gotten to the stage where every day I used enough drugs, reefers, cocaine, or both, so that I felt above any worries, any strains. If any worries did manage to push their way through to the surface of my consciousness, I could float them back where they came from until tomorrow, and then until the next day. But where always before I had been able to smoke the reefers and to sniff the snow and rarely show it very much, by now it was not that easy. One week, when we weren't working, after a big haul, I was just staying high, and I was out nightclubbing. I came into this club, and from the bartender's face when he spoke, "Hello, Red," I knew that something was wrong, but I didn't ask him anything. I've always had this rule. Never ask anybody in that kind of situation. They will tell you what they want you to know. But the bartender didn't get a chance to tell me, if he had meant to. When I sat down on a stool and ordered a drink, I saw them. Sophia and her sister sat at a table inside, near the dance floor, with a white man. I don't know how I ever made such a mistake as I next did. I could have talked to her later. I didn't know or care who the white fellow was. My cocaine told me to get up. It wasn't Sophia's husband. It was his closest friend. They'd served in the war together. With her husband out of town, he'd asked Sophia and her sister out to dinner, and they went. But then later, after dinner, driving around, he'd suddenly suggested going over to the black ghetto. Every Negro that lives in a city has seen the type 1,000 times, the northern cracker who will go to visit Niggertown, to be amused at the coons. The girl, so well known in the Negro places in Roxbury, had tried to change his mind, but he'd insisted. So they just held their breaths coming to this club where they'd been 100 times. They walked in stiff, eyeing the bartenders and waiters who caught their message and acted as though they'd never seen them before. And they were sitting there with drinks before them, praying that no Negro who knew them would barge up to their table. Then up I came. I know I called them baby. They were chalky white. He was beet red. That same night, back at the Harvard Square place, I really got sick. It was less of a physical sickness than it was all of the last 5 years catching up. I was in my pajamas in bed, half asleep, when I heard someone knock. I knew that something was wrong. We all had keys. No one ever knocked at the door. I rolled off and under the bed. I was so groggy it didn't cross my mind to grab for my gun on the dresser. Under the bed I heard the key turn, and I saw the shoes and pants cuffs walk in. I watched them walk around. I saw them stop. Every time they stopped, I knew what the eyes were looking at. And I knew, before he did, that he was going to get down and look under the bed. He did. It was Sophia's husband's friend. His face was about 2 feet from mine. It looked congealed. "I fooled you, didn't I?" I said. It wasn't at all funny. I got out from under the bed, still fake laughing. He didn't run. I'll say that for him. He stood back. He watched me as though I were a snake. I didn't try to hide what he already knew. The girls had some things in the closets and around. He'd seen all of that. We even talked some. I told him the girls weren't there, and he left. What shook me the most was realizing that I trapped myself under the bed without a gun. I really was slipping. I'd put a stolen watch into a jewelry shop to replace a broken crystal. It was about 2 days later, when I went to pick up the watch, that things fell apart. As I've said, a gun was as much a part of my dress as a necktie. I had my gun in a shoulder holster, under my coat. The loser of the watch, the person from whom it had been stolen by us, I later found, had described the repair that it needed. It was a very expensive watch. That's why I'd kept it for myself. And all of the jewelers in Boston had been alerted. The Jew waited until I'd paid him before he laid the watch on the counter. He gave a signal. And this other fellow suddenly appeared from the back, walking toward me. One hand was in his pocket. I knew he was a cop. He said quietly, "Step into the back." Just as I started back there, an innocent Negro walked into the shop. I remember later hearing that he just that day gotten out of the military. The detective, thinking he was with me, turned to him. There I was, wearing my gun, and the detective talking to that Negro with his back to me. Today, I believe that Allah was with me even then. I didn't try to shoot him. And that saved my life. I remember that his name was Detective Slack. I raised my arm and motioned to him. "Here, take my gun." I saw his face when he took it. He was shocked. Because of the sudden appearance of the other Negro, he had never thought about a gun. It really moved him that I hadn't tried to kill him. Then, holding my gun in his hand, he signaled. And out from where they'd been concealed walked two other detectives that had me covered. One false move, I'd have been dead. I was going to have a long time in prison to think about that. If I hadn't been arrested right when I was, I could have been dead another way. Sophia's husband's friend had told her husband about me, and the husband had arrived that morning and had gone to the apartment with a gun looking for me. He was at the apartment just about when they took me to the precinct. The detectives grilled me. They didn't beat me. They didn't even put a finger on me. And I knew it was because I hadn't tried to kill the detective. They got my address from some papers they found on me. The girls soon were picked up. Shorty was pulled right off the bandstand that night. The girls also had implicated Rudy. To this day, I've always marveled at how Rudy, somehow, got the word. And I know he must have caught the first thing smoking out of Boston. And he got away. They never got him. I thought 1,000 times, I guess, about how I so narrowly escaped death twice that day. That's why I believe that everything is written. The cops found the apartment loaded with evidence. Fur coats, some jewelry, other small stuff, plus the tools of our trade. A jimmy, a lockpick, glass cutters, screwdrivers, pencil beam flashlights, false keys. and my small arsenal of guns. The girls got low bail. They were still white. Burglars or not. Their worst crime was their involvement with Negroes. But Shorty and I had bail set at $10,000 each, which they knew we were nowhere near able to raise. The social workers worked on us. White women in league with Negroes was their main obsession. The girls weren't so-called tramps or trash. They were well-to-do upper-middle-class whites. That bothered the social workers and the forces of the law more than anything else. How, where, when had I met them? Did we sleep together? Nobody wanted to know anything at all about the robberies. All they could see was that we'd taken the white man's women. I just looked at the social workers. Now, what do you think? Even the court clerks and the bailiffs, nice white girls, goddamn niggers. It was the same even from our court-appointed lawyers as we sat down under guard at a table as our hearing assembled. Before the judge entered, I said to one lawyer, "We seem to be getting sentenced because of those girls." He got red from the neck up and shuffled his papers. "You had no business with white girls." Later, when I'd learned the full truth about the white man, I reflected many times that the average burglary sentence for a first offender, as we all were, was about 2 years. But we weren't going to get the average. Not for our crime. I want to say before I go on that I have never previously told anyone my sordid past in detail. I haven't done it now, to sound as though I might be proud of how bad, how evil I was. But people are always speculating. Why am I as I am? To understand that of any person, his whole life, from birth, must be reviewed. All of our experiences fuse into our personality. Everything that ever happened to us is an ingredient. Today, when everything that I do has an urgency, I would not spend 1 hour in the preparation of a book which had the ambition to perhaps titillate some readers. But I am spending many hours because the full story is the best way that I know to have it seen and understood. That I had sunk to the very bottom of the American white man society when, soon now, in prison, I found Allah and the religion of Islam, and it completely transformed my life. Chapter 10, Satan. Shorty didn't know what the word concurrently meant. Somehow, Lansing to Boston bus fare had been scraped up by Shorty's old mother. "Son, read the book of Revelations and pray to God," she kept telling Shorty, visiting him, and once me, while we awaited our sentencing. Shorty had read the Bible's Revelation pages. He had actually gotten down on his knees, praying like some Negro Baptist deacon. Then we were looking up at the judge in Middlesex County Court. Our, I think, 14 counts of crime were committed in that county. Shorty's mother was sitting, sobbing, with her head bowing up and down to her Jesus, over near Ella and Reginald. Shorty was the first of us called to stand up. "Count 1, 8 to 10 years. Count 2, 8 to 10 years. Count 3, and finally, the sentences to run concurrently." Shorty, sweating so hard that his black face looked as though it had been greased, and not understanding the word concurrently, had counted in his head to probably over 100 years. He cried out. He began slumping. The bailiffs had to catch and support him. In 8 to 10 seconds, Shorty had turned as atheist as I had been to start with. I got 10 years. The girls got 1 to 5 years in the women's reformatory at Framingham, Massachusetts. This was in February 1946. I wasn't quite 21. I'd not even started shaving. They took Shorty and me, handcuffed together, to the Charlestown State Prison. I can't remember any of my prison numbers. That seems surprising, even after the dozen years since I've been out of prison. Because your number in prison became part of you. You never heard your name, only a number. On all of your clothing, every item was your number, stenciled. It grew stenciled on your brain. Any person who claims to have deep feeling for other human beings should think a long, long time before he votes to have other men kept behind bars. Caged. I'm not saying there shouldn't be prisons, but there shouldn't be bars. Behind bars, a man never reforms. He will never forget. He never will get completely over the memory of the bars. After he gets out, his mind tries to erase the experience, but he can't. I've talked with numerous former convicts. It has been very interesting to me to find that all of our minds had blotted away many details of years in prison. But in every case, he will tell you that he can't forget those bars. As a fish, prison slang for a new inmate, at Charlestown, I was physically miserable and as evil-tempered as a snake, being suddenly without drugs. The cells didn't have running water. The prison had been built in 1805, in Napoleon's day, and was even styled after the Bastille. In the dirty, cramped cell, I could lie on my cot and touch both walls. The toilet was a covered pail. I don't care how strong you are, you can't stand having to smell a whole cell row of defecation. End of side 4.